Hey, how's it going, y'all? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Pardon me, just got to tune into Fox News here. Got my closed captions running. Go ahead and give me the fake news. Fox News. Oh, yeah, see? Officer Bob's going to attack your mall. Cool. I'm so glad I turned on Fox. Yeah, might as well start the show with this today. Could happen. I've been saying for years, I think it's a miracle that we have not had attacks, especially on the Mall of America there in Minneapolis. There's a huge population of Somali Americans there. I'm not trying to indict them or smear them or call them names or accuse them of being terrorists. I'm just saying there's a huge population of them, and there are have been at least a couple of dozen who have left the United States to go to Somalia to fight with al-Shabaab against the American-backed African Union occupation and sock puppet government in Mogadishu. So, it doesn't take very much imagination, if the fight is against America in Somalia, for one of these guys to decide that he's going to stay here and fight. And then al-Shabaab tactics we've already seen. They seem to think attacking malls full of innocent civilians is good public relations. And I guess from the point of view, you know, the position that they're in, I guess it is. I'm surely not trying to give anybody ideas, but then again, to me, the idea is so obvious that I don't really, you know, question saying it out loud. I mean, I really wouldn't want to, you know, give anybody an idea, but I think it's so obvious anybody could come up with it if, you know, themselves. Don't listen to me. But I think it's a miracle, and I think that, you know, if my management company ran the Mall of America, boy, would I have some badass security guards up there. I would have real ass security guards with real rifles and briefed that this is a target, okay? So look out, not playing around like, you know, guarding every back door of Foley's from robbery and that kind of thing. It could happen. I think, you know, so far we've been really lucky, honestly, that it hasn't happened. And it's part of just being at war for this long in a row. I mean, really, when it comes to the, you know, so-called lone wolf attacks and all of that stuff, I think we've just been incredibly lucky. The very few genuine attacks that we've had, by genuine I mean not FBI entrapment jobs, but they've almost all been failures. Fort Hood was a successful attack to whatever degree. He did kill a number of people there. But then you had Zazi in Denver. He got caught, and not by illegal NSA surveillance, but perfectly legal surveillance by the Brits on a jihadist email account that he was in contact with. So that was Zazi, that was one. And then there was the shoe bomber, the underpants bomber, the Times Square bomber, all of whom failed miserably. And just think of all the orange alerts that never came true. You know, lies that they tortured out of guys, mostly. But just think about all the attacks on, you know, I don't know, ball games or city council meetings or whatever it is that haven't happened. Look at how much chaos, one lunatic can cause at a school shooting. Well, what if you had some guys screaming, you know, loyalty to al-Baghdadi or to Ayman al-Zawahiri as they went into a school and did one of those? We've been incredibly lucky. And part of it is just because we live in North America. Thank God for that. You know, assuming that the federal police are doing their jobs at all, it should be pretty easy to keep suspects out of the country. And we see, you know, with how much abandon and overkill they're willing to use those no-fly lists. Remember, and I had forgotten this anecdote, and I was called out for it in the chat room, and so, hey, great point, man. I'm sorry that I had forgotten it. They admitted. Was it Patrick Kennedy from the State Department admitted that they had decided they wanted to watch Abdul Muttalib, and that was why they let him get on the plane. in the Netherlands and change planes to the United States. They just didn't imagine that he had the bomb on him. He went ahead and admitted that under oath in front of the Congress. You might remember that at the time, Richard Wolff. Do you remember who that is from MSNBC? He's got kind of silver hair. He was a very, like, trusted lackey type liberal reporter who was allowed access into the White House, who I believe was allowed to interview Obama at length for a book that he wrote, a hagiography. He's the David Frum of the Democrats, basically. And he went on MSNBC that night and said that the president, it seemed like the White House, going around even their own National Security Council and everything else, the White House sent Richard Wolff out with this talking point to say on MSNBC that Obama was worried that someone in the intelligence community was setting him up by letting that attack through, because of how easy it would have, could have, should have been to stop. So anyway, we have been incredibly lucky, but, you know, firearms are legal in America, as they should be, but that also means that it'd be pretty easy for somebody to take one or two and go to a mall and cause enough economic damage with the backlash and the panic and the PR and all the overreaction to, you know, it'd be worth it for them to try it, is what I'm saying. It's a pretty obvious kind of target. And anyway, certainly good for the Department of Homeland Security, which is facing a funding problem. In fact, I read a thing at Vox, if you could believe that, where they were saying, let's just abolish the Department of Homeland Security. Spin all these things back. You wonder what's gone wrong, so wrong with the Secret Service lately. Part of what's wrong with the Secret Service is that they used to be under Treasury. And as soon as they were moved to the Department of Homeland Security, they just started acting all political instead of professional and failing at their job. Anyway, that's one small part of it, obviously. But it's worth a look. I'm actually very happy to see that at a very center-left mainstream journalistic venture like Vox, it's okay to, you know, call for such things as dissolution of the Department of Homeland Security. And, you know, it seems like now's as good a time as any, although that's not really the fight that's going on in Congress. The fight going on in Congress is just over money between these or those guys, you know, who gets paid with our taxes. Hey, all right, well, anyway, I've gone on enough about that. If you want to know about Somalia, just type in my name, Scott Horton, and Somalia, and you can read my article that I wrote for the Future Freedom Foundation back almost 2 years ago now, called U.S. Government to Blame for Somalia's Misery. And that'll get you a little bit caught up on what's going on there. And, yeah, I think you could probably find that reprinted at my site, scotthorton.org. /articles, but you can also find my interview archives there. You can find the chat room, the whole show archives, and all kinds of stuff there at scotthorton.org. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, Andy Worthington on Guantanamo, Jeff Tucker on liberty.me, and our new show that starts tomorrow night, which shall be fun. And one more show note for you here, and that is that I got a new sponsor lined up here. It's Taxpayers United of America, and they're doing this real cool thing. Hopefully you'll hear the spot here coming up on the show sometime soon. But they're doing this thing where they're going across 10 states in 6 months, and they're doing these workshops to teach how young activists, perhaps like yourself, how to sue under the Freedom of Information Act to find out just how much the tax parasites, I mean the government employees in your community, are making on their big fat pensions and their big fat early retirements at your expense. And it sounds like a great project to me. I think you'll be interested. Check it out, taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Remember I mentioned to you that thing last week about how David Hicks's conviction was overturned? His war crimes conviction from Guantanamo Bay. He obviously just was forced to take a plea, and so he took it, but he never was guilty of any war crimes. And Andy Worthington's got a new piece at Al Jazeera saying, hey, this is a big deal. This could actually spell the end of the Guantanamo military commission system. That sounds crazy to me, too, but we're going to hear him out. Yeah. Anyway, so, yeah. Hey, man, there was this article at War is Boring, and it was called, this is the, I'm making this up, pretty close, though, paraphrasing. This is the movie that got Ronald Reagan to change his mind on nuclear proliferation. Something like that. And what it is, it's the movie. You may have seen it depending on how old you are and how much TV you watch. It's called The Day After. And it came out in 1983, and it's got Steve Guttenberg in it. And, oh, that one old guy whose name I always remember when I'm seeing his face. What was his name again? Anyway. Steve Guttenberg, right? I had you sold at Steve Guttenberg. If you go to my Twitter feed, you can find the link to the video there. The whole movie is on YouTube, actually. But I'm sure you can get it off the Pirate Bay or wherever you like. Anyway, the point of the movie is America and the Soviet Union get into a war over the line in Germany, and they have a nuclear war, and 300-something nuclear missiles hit the United States and completely destroy it. And the point of the movie is not, oh, Ronald Reagan's bad, or oh, the Russians are bad, or anything like that, as much as it sets up, you know, kind of a plausible scenario for the start of the war. The Russians pouring through the Fulda Gap, and they claim they've been provoked into doing it, and blah, blah, blah. And anyway, the point of the movie is, this is what an actual H-bomb war in America would look like. And you could gloat all you want about, yeah, we got them too, but that ain't going to make you feel much better when Kansas City no longer exists. And everyone who lived there also no longer exists. And so that's what the movie's about. It's about some people in Kansas, and they get exploded by H-bombs. And it's the end of human civilization. And, of course, as they say at the end of the movie, this is totally playing down the real bad effects of what an actual nuclear war, thermonuclear war, full-scale exchange would look like. It would be the end of civilization for at least generations and generations and generations. And maybe for good. And the thing of it is, I really like, and I've heard this, you know, it's been repeated, it's in Ronald Reagan's diary, it's in his biographies, etc., that this movie really made a big impact on him. Oh, I hate using that word that way. It had a big effect on him. Impact is when one thing hits another, you know. I'm a Carlinian on that kind of thing. Always correct me if you catch me slipping. But it really changed Ronald Reagan's mind about some things. And it was, and he said so, and then directly after that, he pursued a whole new round of treaty negotiations and nuclear arms reductions with the USSR. And the thing about it is this, and the only reason I kind of go on about it, it's not because I'm some patchouli stinking hippie, oh, no nukes, man, or whatever. It's just that, isn't it strange that we live in a society where you would associate opposition to nuclear weapons with patchouli stinking hippies? That's not the unanimous consensus of all 300 million of us in this country, of all 7 billion of us on this planet. That it's insane. It's insane to allow politicians of any nationality to own hydrogen bombs. Have you ever seen a picture of an H-bomb going off? As the doctor says in the movie, Hiroshima is peanuts. Hiroshima is nothing. A couple of 100,000 killed. The Nagasaki bomb, which was actually more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb, but because of the terrain and topography at Nagasaki was a bit less lethal. It still killed 100,000-something people. But anyway, That Nagasaki bomb, as Daniel Ellsberg likes to emphasize, is just the blasting cap for an H-bomb. That's the percussion cap that sets the H-bomb off, is an A-bomb. That's why you always hear people talking about cold fusion, because if we could fuse atoms together at room temperature, we'd have enough free energy for everybody, forever, for everything. Unfortunately, nobody can figure out how to do it at room temperature. What they have figured out is how to do fusion at approximately the temperature of the sun. And so that's what they do. They set off a Nagasaki bomb to make it as hot as the sun so that then fusion becomes possible. And when they fuse the hydrogen atoms together, that's what causes the tens of megatons sized explosion that could kill all of Dallas, Texas in one shot. That's a big city if you never know. I'm picking big cities near my home. Certainly it would kill all of Austin, Texas in one shot. From the very south side to the very north side. With 10 or 20 or 30 megatons done. And so, you know what? Geez, I don't know, man. I guess if the Americans were just absolutely determined to wrest Ukraine away from Russian influence, no matter the cost, and we were to have a full-scale conventional war with them, that would be absolutely horrible. Something on the order of 60 million people died in World War II, and of course, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, those were just the remainder on the very end. Another 500,000 at the end, you know? But an H-bomb war with Russia over Ukraine or over anything else would be the end of much of mankind. You know, Ellsberg really likes to point out the fires, man. Never even mind the giant explosions, and never even mind all the gamma radiation everywhere. The forest fires. The city fires. With no one to put them out, ever. It'd be enough to blacken the sky. It'd be enough to cause a nuclear winter. In fact, recent studies say even a very limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan at this point would be enough to put entire harvests planet-wide into severe jeopardy. Because of the fires. And anyway, so there's my opposition to nuclear weapons. There's my kind of just scratching my head, can't understand why all of humanity is not at once united against our politicians' so-called right or authority to own these devices, to hold humanity hostage with these weapons. It's insane. It's absolutely crazy. And what's even crazier is the fact that nobody even cares or talks about this kind of thing hardly at all. It's not even a political issue in America at all. People just assume the danger's over, but it's not. Read Ellsberg at Truth Dig about nukes. Trust me. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, I got Andy Worthington on Guantanamo Bay. Good old Andy, man. He might be a Brit, but he's an American hero to me. And then Jeff Tucker's going to be on the show to talk about Liberty.me and to talk about some things and to talk about our new show that we're starting tomorrow night. Did you know that we're starting a new show tomorrow night on Liberty.me? Eye on the Empire, it'll be called. Very good. So I have seen it mentioned. Thanks, Bill, for the email. I have seen it mentioned a couple of times that Laura Poitras got the Oscar for being the director of Citizen 4. That's pretty cool. You know, I haven't even seen that. I downloaded it from the Pirate Bay a couple of weeks ago because I finally saw it on the Pirate Bay. But then, well, maybe a week ago or something. But I haven't gotten around to watching it yet. And the thing is I was thinking about the things that I had read about it, and the things that I had read about it really kind of pissed me off. The things that I had read about it said that it was all about Snowden, the character, and that at no point in the damn movie do they stop and say, here's what we've learned from this stuff. Here's, I don't know, 4 minutes of animation showing you some, some kind of diagram of the American telecommunications industry and its relationship to the government and where and what they're getting and how. They're doing this under 1233. They're doing this under Patriot Act 215. They're doing this. Oh, that's Executive Order 1233, whatever. Patriot Act, Section 215. And then there's another one, the FISA Amendments Act, Section 702. Well, so what is it that they're doing under what authority? And what are they doing without any pretended authority at all? And what are they getting at rest? And what are they getting in motion? And what are they stealing from Google? And what are they, how deeply into the Apple cloud have they hacked and the rest? Tell me the story. I want to know the damn story. You know how hard it is to read 100 articles in a row about all the Snowden stuff and then just, I don't know what, squint really hard and wish you were as smart as Marcy Wheeler and that all this stuff is just perfectly clear. Oh, yeah, I totally understand what's going on here now. Show me some damn, 5 minutes of animation explaining what it is they're doing. Instead, what do we got? An hour and a half of Snowden in his hotel room. But then again, I haven't seen it. So maybe it really does deserve the Oscar. But that was what I read about it, that it was all about the personalities and the breaking of the story and the whole drama of the story and meeting in Hong Kong and all of that, but without actually telling the damn story, which is, this is what we found out the NSA is doing, right? Guys, did I miss it? Chat room guys, have you seen it? Am I getting it wrong here? I guess I should watch the damn thing. And I like Ed Snowden. I mean, my advice would have been, just stay off the radar and let the journalists handle it from here. Because I think him turning himself into a kind of mini celebrity and all that, it sort of undercuts from the story. Personally, that's my view of it. But I like the guy. I think he did what he did for all the right reasons. I know that all the hype about how, he's given all our secrets to the Chinese and the Russians is just a bunch of crap. If you ever believed that for a minute, you need to ask yourself, what is wrong with your brain? And you let cynical liars tell it what to think all the time. All that is a bunch of nonsense. In fact, there's a great piece in the New Yorker about Sarah Harrison from WikiLeaks who came and smuggled him out of there and out of Hong Kong. Remember, it was Obama that stripped him of his passport and left him stranded in Russia. He wanted to go to South America where the CIA could have got their hands on him easy and killed him or brought him back for trial. But they left him stranded in Russia where he'd be safe and sound. How come the Republicans never attack Obama about that? Anyway, I think what he did was important because he was letting us know. And yeah, letting the whole world know because, hey, that's how it works. That, as Glenn Greenwald likes to always put it, that the National Security Agency's goal is to turn the entire internet into its surveillance tool. That's it. They want the entire thing to work against us for them. Now, in my view, that's what it's always been. The entire telecommunications system in America has been built with the NSA from the ground up, from World War II on, from before that, from World War I on. And so, what it is that they're not getting, I think, would be the more important story. But anyway, I mean, what Snowden has done is absolutely heroic and has really helped to clarify this stuff down to the details for the people who understand it that well. I really should have maybe Trevor Tim back on the show to talk about, like, hey, so what all exactly have you learned from Snowden here that's so important? Because there's a hell of a lot. But anyway, congratulations to him and Poitras and Greenwald and them for winning their little award. I don't ever watch those award shows. I'm sorry if you love them. I just could not care less. I watched some hilarious Dave Chappelle, though, man. That's nice for nostalgia reasons. You know, he did the Black George Bush. Do you remember that one? Be real, real, son. Yeah, that was good. All right. Yeah, I talked about nukes. Let's talk about the ISIS war. At Kurdish frontline outpost, skepticism abounds about assault on Mosul. This is our friend Mitch Prothero at McClatchy Newspapers. And the deal is here that, as you may have heard, a general told the Jordanian press that we're going to attack Mosul. The United States is going to help coordinate a Shiite attack on Mosul here in the spring. Well, they're surprised to find that out. It's not going to happen at all. Nobody's ready at all. And here, Prothero's with the Kurdish Peshmerga. Oh, he's got some pictures here now of these Kurdish Peshmerga fighters. And, quote, "There really is no Iraqi army." I'm not quoting Prothero. I'm quoting the Kurdish fighters that he's talking to. "There really is no Iraqi army, so I don't know where they get the idea they can train 25,000 soldiers in 2 months to fight house to house in Mosul." This whole thing is a joke. You know, I was asking Coburn last week on the show. Well, so, okay. Obviously, the army just melted away from Mosul and turned tail and ran, and a lot of it was ghost soldiers, made up names there just to, pad the bank accounts of the officers and all of this. As Coburn was explaining long before the fall of Mosul, for years on this show, he was explaining the Iraqi army was really no such thing. It was a hollow force and a corrupt force. But so then I says to Coburn, I says, well, but now the guys that are left, I mean, they're hardcore, right? And so now somebody's taking control of them and is training and arming them and getting them ready to be a professional army to go and fight this war, huh? And Cobra's like, I guess there must be some, but yeah, no. And then this seems to be the consensus here with Prothero's reporting too, is that there really is no Iraqi army. Very little. It's the Shiite militias, which after all, the Iraqi army was nothing but the Badr Brigade in the first place, really. Remember 9 years and 2.5 months ago when George W. Bush announced the strategy for victory in a big speech at the Council on Foreign Relations? We'll stand up. They'll stand down. Wait, strike that. Reverse it. I got it right for a second. I'm sorry. I meant to say it the way George Bush said it. We'll stand down when they stand up. And we're standing them up now. Right now. We're training them up. It's going to be the army of the Iraqi people. There to protect their new democracy from those who undermine it. Yeah, remember? Remember how they spent, they claim only $50 billion, but it must have been more like three times that, training and arming the Iraqi army? Hardly exists. And go read this, Prothero. It's McClatchy at Kurdish Frontline Outposts. Skepticism abounds. There is no one prepared to invade Mosul. No one. So that's why they keep talking about U.S. ground troops. They're going to need them if they want to sack Mosul. Because the Iraqi army and the Kurds ain't going to do it for him. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself, WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So, Patrick Coburn says that his estimate is there's up to 100,000 fighters, and they're still being bankrolled by private donors throughout the Gulf region, according to the chief of staff to the Kurdish president, Barzani, in an interview there. And the thing it is that, sounds right to me. I don't know about the numbers. Although, does seem like the 20 to 30,000 is a lowball estimate on the part of the CIA. I don't know if it's as many as 100,000 guys or not, but anyway, it is certainly the case that since 2011, the United States and its allies, primarily Qatar, Saudi, and Turkey, have been bankrolling and arming and coordinating the rebels in Syria. Now, that does not mean that I'm saying that Obama had a deliberate plan to build up the Islamic State. I think they thought, you know, come on, these guys are nothing but a bunch of even the extremists who do the fighting. They're still just bands of militia lunatics, right? You know, waving their AK in the air and screaming Allah and whatever. What kind of threat could they ever be? It's the same kind, you know, some stirred up Muslims, as Brzezinski put it about the aftermath of the jihad in the 1980s in Afghanistan against the Russians. And they just thought, hey, this will be useful. Because, hey, where the Saudis, the Turks, and the Israelis, and the Qataris, too, all hate Assad and want rid of him, well, then, I guess that makes perfect sense for the Americans to follow that policy, then, they think. As Barack Obama told Jeffrey Goldberg, yes, you're right, Jeffrey. Taking Assad out and peeling Syria away from Iran would be a great way to weaken Iran. That was it. That was the conversation. Obama, you can read it at The Atlantic. Obama and Jeffrey Goldberg. The headline is, I don't bluff. As president, I don't bluff. And that's him assuring Jeffrey Goldberg that, yes, we're going to talk with the Iranians, but no, we're not going to let them have nukes. The talks are about keeping them from having nukes. But then Goldberg says, hey, man, taking out Assad in Syria be a good way to hurt the Iranians? And Obama says, yeah, that's right. And he says, I can't tell you everything that we're doing because it's a secret. I can tell you, but I have to kill you, Jeffrey Goldberg, kind of a joke. And so this has been going on. And now I've seen some reports, I don't know, really quotable stuff saying that, yeah, the Saudis really were paying the Islamic State and al-Nusra too. It's possible. And I mean the Saudi government. My understanding is that their favorite group was Arar al-Sham, which was a.k.a. known as the, also a.k.a. known as, can you do that? Also known as the Islamic Front, which was Arar al-Sham and some other groups. But then they've all turned coat and joined up with al-Nusra or ISIS anyway. As I've been telling you on this show since 2011, throughout 2012, 13, 14, moderates don't fight in a civil war like what's happening in Syria right now. And it's not even really a sectarian war, as has been explained by so many guests on this show, that a great number of Sunni Arabs also support Assad. It's not everybody versus the Sunnis or the Sunnis versus everybody. It's kind of the poor countryside Sunnis versus the business class, the merchant class that supports the Ba'athist government. Along with the Kurds, Druze, Chaldean and Maronite Christians, and of course the Shiites and Alawites. They're the coalition that supports the Assad government there. So, you know, there is something to it being a broad-based popular rebellion from actual Sunnis. It's not like everyone fighting has been imported from Saudi Arabia, but pretty much, you know, the foreign fighters have certainly taken a huge part of the lead, and even as far as the Syrians fighting, they're a bunch of AQI vets, mostly. They're the Syrians who went and fought against the Americans and the Shiites in the last war in Iraq that we've been back in this whole time in Syria. And so now why should it be that Saudi and Qatar and whatever other, you know, Kuwaiti sheiks and whatever, why should it be that they would change their mind completely about their policy and that they would stop bankrolling these Mujahideen just because they sacked Mosul? Boy, talk about sticking it to the Iranians and limiting the power of the Iranian sock puppet government in Baghdad. It's working. And if the answer is because at some point, right, like after the fall of Mosul and the declaration of the caliphate, well, at that point, Obama had to have called them and told them to knock it off. You're our allies, but this has gotten way out of control now. No. Nope, not at all. And even when there has been recent indications, like in the New York Times, remember they had that piece a couple of weeks ago about how, yeah, they're over it. They're going to keep Assad. They're switching back to Assad. And, you know, they agree with the Turks about arming some rebels, but they won't say who they're going to fight. Well, the theory is they're supposed to fight the Assad government, which is, of course, backed by Hezbollah, Iran, and Russia, as well as all those groups that I just mentioned. But those are the external backers. And they're the American-backed moderate Mujahideen are supposed to take on them and al-Nusra and the Islamic State all at the same time. Anyway, count to 10 and they'll all have joined al-Nusra, just like all the guys that were trained up before. But here Obama is saying, well, wait, first a couple of things of what we're talking about here. There's a piece in FAIR today by Adam Johnson, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. U.S. backing for, quote, moderate Syrian rebels, long reported, continually forgotten. And he's quoting a lot of media saying, yes, we're about to begin training these guys. And he's saying, yeah, it's funny because you've been training them since at least 2012. And here's a bunch of sources saying so. Here's even the New York Times saying that, yeah, all the guns that we keep sending to the battlefield keep ending up in the hands of the jihadis. Surprise, surprise, surprise. It's been going on for years, as he documents here. And then there's this one I mentioned last week where Robert Ford, and I saw him backpedaling a little bit on Twitter, but Robert Ford, former ambassador to Syria and number one proponent of arming up these so-called moderates, is now changing his mind. And he's saying, geez, the so-called moderates seem to keep going over to Nusra and ISIS. Unless we're going to do everything necessary to help them win, which would be an entire invasion, Iraq-sized invasion, then we should really knock it off. I also saw a clip of Thomas McInerney, the warmonger on Fox News, and he wasn't saying, oh, the al-Nusra is rising because we didn't do enough to back the moderates and all that. It's not that line, which you would expect. The John McCain line, I'm ashamed, we haven't done enough. Oh, no, that was about backing the Nazis in Ukraine. Different, same difference, but different. But no, that wasn't the line. McInerney, if you're not familiar, he's a former, I think, Air Force officer and very right-wing nationalist, hawk, and go-to guy for the hawks on Fox News. And he said, listen, I think, frankly, we picked some of the wrong people to back here. And he's saying we, speaking for the national security state, the military and the CIA, not Obama. He wouldn't say, Obama backed the wrong guys. It wasn't one of those. It was we backed the wrong guys. We, the royal we, meaning the national security state. Yeah, I think maybe we backed some of the wrong guys there, and now they've gone over to al-Nusra and to ISIS. And so we have helped to create this ISIS problem. Those are the kinds of admissions you can take to the bank. But then you look at, now back to a couple of paragraphs ago, where the New York Times was saying Obama's given up on this. He's switching back to Assad because, what, are you crazy? And yet now here he is saying, no, the Islamic State defeat hinges on a stable Syria. And since the Assad regime keeps defending itself from the Mujahideen, keeps fighting, and yes, they do massacre civilians. It is a horrible fascist police state, and they do bomb neighborhoods and whatever. I'm not really defending the Assad regime. I sure as hell am not advocating allying with them, but I absolutely am not advocating allying with the cousins of the 9/11 hijackers who have been fighting him the last few years here. But anyway, here Obama is in the Wall Street Journal saying, no, listen, the Syrian civil war will only end when there is an inclusive political transition and a government that serves Syrians of all ethnicities and religion. So I guess you could read that like, oh, a transition, like he's kind of backing away from regime change. But that's the same phrase that they've been using to mean Assad must step down before any kind of rebel group should even have to talk to him. That's been their position. Now, They've kind of softened their rhetoric at times, but now here's Obama right back again. And then, of course, combined again with the Wall Street Journal piece that the U.S. is going to give some of the Syrian rebels the authority to call in American airstrikes. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com.
This debate is occurring because of the Supreme Court's ruling that said that we must conduct ourselves under the common Article 3 of the Geneva Convention. And that common Article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague. What does that mean?
All right, welcome back. It's the show, the Scott Horton Show. Sorry for the second of dead air there. I was late getting Andy on the line. But I got Andy on the line. It's our friend Andy Worthington. He may be a Brit, but he's an American hero. Author of the Guantanamo Files, which is really the files on all of everybody, 700 and almost 800 men who were ever held in the Guantanamo Bay prison. And, of course, he also is the director of the documentary Outside the Law. His website is andyworthington.co.uk. Oh, and you can find him at the Future Freedom Foundation, fff.org as well. But andyworthington.co.uk is his website, and he's now writing for aljazeera.com. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Andy?
Yeah, I'm good. It's nice to be talking to you again, Scott.
Yeah, very happy to have you back on the show. So, really important good news here, I think, if I'm reading you right. The collapse of Guantanamo's military commissions. The dismissal of David Hicks's terror conviction casts doubt on the future of Guantanamo's trial system. So take us back. Who's David Hicks? What happened with his case? And why does it matter?
Well, you know, David Hicks is an Australian guy, you know, a young adventurer who had, you know, gone out to Afghanistan and happened to be out there, you know, when the U.S.-led invasion happened following the 9/11 attacks and was swept up in the dragnet of people out there. And as a white guy, you know, there was obviously money available for him, I think. He was then, you know, treated really pretty appallingly in custody, as the few white prisoners were. You know, I'm sure everybody remembers the American Taliban, John Walker Lind, and how appallingly he was treated. And then eventually when, after a number of false starts, the Bush administration was trying to prove the credibility of its military commission trial system, the one that they'd dragged out from the history books, instead of prosecuting people if they committed crimes in federal court, then they came up with the idea that they would try and do Hicks, presumably for being a white man in a foreign country, at a time when that wasn't a good thing to do, because there was no evidence that Hicks had ever done anything to anybody. And, you know, the best way when you haven't got any evidence against somebody but you want something to stick is to suggest that they would be better off with a plea deal, and that's exactly what happened in Hicks's case. And, in fact, you know, he had correctly figured that it was probably the only way he was going to get out of there, and got a very lenient plea deal.
No.
In that he was almost immediately sent home to Australia in 2007, just after the plea deal in March.
Was he ever even accused of killing Americans or killing Northern Alliance members or anyone else?
No, he wasn't accused of killing anybody. He was just accused of providing material support for terrorism, which, you know, in the context of the war on terror meant, you know, that he was in Afghanistan appearing to be supporting the Taliban, you know, which in the hyped up post 9/11 world is something that the US wants to make into a war crime. So, you know, so there's Hicks. I mean, he got back, you know, in April 2007, was imprisoned for a little while. And then by the end of 2007, he was a free man. Except, of course, you know, he'd been through this terrible ordeal, was regarded as a, you know, as a convicted terrorist in his homeland. And, you know, this is a great vindication of, you know, what he's always said, which is, you know, how could I be a war criminal? I didn't do anything. As well as being, as I mentioned in the article, Scott, you know, another nail in the coffin, hopefully, for the military commissions.
Right. Okay. So now what is this recent court ruling that has thrown out his plea?
Well, the court ruling actually took place in the fall of 2012. The first major ruling. So what people need to know is that there have been eight convictions in the Military Commission since the War on Terror began. Two of those have been in trials, and the rest of them have been plea deals. So eight in all. Only a couple of those guys are still held. The rest of them, you know, also, like Hicks, found out that the only way to get out of Guantanamo was to come up with some kind of guilty plea, and then you would actually be released while all the nobodies continue to be held. So in the fall of 2012, the D.C. Circuit Court, so the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., kicked out the conviction against Salim Hamdan. Now, he was a Yemeni guy who had been one of a pool of drivers for Osama bin Laden. So a man who knew nothing about anything but was working for a bad guy. So they threw out the material support for terrorism charge. And in fact, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, sometimes by their own people, had pointed out that making material support for terrorism into a war crime was a non-starter because it isn't a war crime. You can prosecute material support for terrorism in a federal court, but there's no history of it being triable by marriage or commission. And in fact, many voices said, if this goes to appeal, it's pretty sure that you're going to lose. So that's what happened. There then followed a similar dismissal of a conviction in another case against a man called Ali Hamza al-Balul, who'd made promotional videos for al-Qaeda. There is a little bit of complicated stuff about whether all the charges against him have been dismissed, which I won't go into. It's almost impossible to understand unless you're, you know, very seriously into the law. But that was basically, you know, the second conviction went on material support. Conspiracy also seems to have gone. So then in the new year, what happened was that a third conviction was kicked out, this time by the convening authority, who is the official responsible for overseeing who is charged in the military commissions. So that was against a Sudanese guy called Nur Uthman Muhammad. He'd been a sometime trainer in a training camp in Afghanistan, nothing to do with al-Qaeda. He had got 3¾ years for a plea deal, so he'd gone home at the end of 2013. And now comes Hicks. So of the eight convictions, four of them have now been kicked out. It's looking about as bad as it could do for the credibility of this trial system, and deservedly so, Scott. I mean, you know, this has been a farce from the very beginning.
Yeah, it has. I don't know about the law. Well, what about attacking the Pentagon, attacking using hijacked airplanes to attack the towers? Does that count as a war crime, or that's just a felony terrorism charge just like any other?
Well, it's a crime, isn't it? Because unfortunately, if you make a terrorist attack, in, you know, however horrible, into an act of war, then you make the people who did that into warriors, and you're kind of playing into their hands. Now, you know, these guys are trying to make the argument that they're engaged in a war. The mistake that the Bush administration did and that the Obama administration hasn't done away with is failing to understand that's playing into their hands. That what you need to get back to is treating a crime as a crime. It's a horrible crime, but many crimes are horrible. But it's a crime. And that's what should have happened. And that's obviously, what I think needs to happen now is for the military commissions to be given up. And now, that's not to say that they're not trying to prosecute these much more serious capital offenses within the military commission system, and, you know, on paper, they're entitled to do that. The problem, of course, is that these are all people who were lavishly tortured by the United States government and its representatives. So every few months, there's a pre-trial hearing at Guantanamo in these cases of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other people. And, you know, as well as I do, Scott, they've been going on for years. And every time they get together, basically the defense is saying, we cannot have anything resembling a fair trial unless we can have our clients be able to talk about the terrible things that happened to them when they were held in black sites. And on the other side, you've got the prosecution saying, under no circumstances can we possibly proceed with anything should these people be allowed to mention a word about anything that's ever happened.
Stop right there. We'll be right back with Andy Worthington. Just one sec, guys. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, talking with the great Andy Worthington. And I'm sorry about the heartbreak and the interruption and all that, Andy. Hey, tell me, by the way, can you hear the bumper music okay and the commercials?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, just making sure. I need to run some tests on this stuff. Anyway, listen, it's great to have you on. Where we were interrupted, you were talking about how we can't, even when the military commission is moving forward, it's moving forward at a snail's pace. Hey, every pretrial hearing is a disaster. You've counted up their legacy of victory against cooks and innocent children like Omar Khadr and the occasional chauffeur. But when it comes to Ramzi bin al-Shib and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who admitted and bragged to Al Jazeera that they did 9/11 before anybody ever tortured them into admitting so, and plus all the great journalism that backs that up as well, they just don't ever seem to get tried. Every time they show up in court, their defense attorney makes a squeak, and he's always got a great point. And so everything ends up getting put off and put off, and the judges find out that the CIA's been spying on them through the smoke detectors, and they say, give us another six-month extension now. And it's a farce. It's not that it's just a kangaroo court in how unfair it is. It's that it's a joke. Andy, I think is what you were saying there before.
I am saying it's a joke, much more than I'm saying it's a kangaroo court, because the intention of the Bush administration, you know, and Cheney was really driving this, was a kangaroo court. You know, they wanted, no due process. They said someone was guilty. They wanted, you know, compliant military judges to agree. And, you know, from early on, you know, they had a number of prosecutors who wouldn't play ball. And they also, you know, had judges who said, Look, I'm not going to preside over a kangaroo court. What I'm going to do is we're going to do this properly. And there were a number of judges in the early days who made life very difficult for the Bush administration. But, you know, but the fact is, Scott, it isn't going to work, I don't think. And it would be much more sensible for everybody, not least the people who are still hoping for justice, who lost relatives in those attacks such a long time ago, for there to be trials. And, you know, Eric Holder had suggested back in 2009, in November 2009, that there would be trials for those people accused of the 9/11 attacks in New York in federal court. And mm-hmm. when you know, various people on the ground and positions of authority then started to push back against that, the Obama administration collapsed on the point, refused to back Eric Holder, and, you know, we're stuck with the inappropriate trial venue. I can only see that we're only ever going to get any kind of resolution by actually folding the whole thing, moving these guys to the U.S. mainland and putting them on trial in federal court. Now, Congress doesn't want that, but, you know.
Which, by the way, would be a virtual 100% guaranteed conviction, right? You hand these guys over to the Justice Department, they're going to charge them with 150,000 felonies, and the chances of them ever getting out of the supermax that they're locked in after that are nothing. Nothing. And it doesn't matter whether they've been tortured, even if you throw out all the torture evidence, it doesn't matter. They want convictions in federal court of anyone, they can have them. Right? I mean,
well,
who gets acquitted in federal
court?
Nobody.
Yeah, I mean, my suggestion would be that if they can come up with anything that resembles evidence against these guys, then a jury will convict them. And, you know, just the sad thing, really, Scott, is that...
And that won't be hard for the actually guilty either. You know, it might be hard to get a conviction in federal court against Omar Khadr since he's innocent, right?
Yeah,
but when it comes to convicting Ramzi bin al-Shib, that won't be difficult, you know?
Yeah.
Even if you exclude all what he told them under torture.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I agree with you, yeah. And all they've done to date is, is waste everybody's time, humiliate themselves, and end up with things like, that wretched plea deal, in the Omar Khadr's case, which we've spoken about in the past, of somebody who was a juvenile who almost certainly didn't even commit the act of which they're accused, which is, throwing a grenade during wartime in a battle, which is not a war crime. I mean, the whole thing, what an absolute disgrace. We'll see. I mean, my point of writing the article was just, every time there's that kind of victory, I'm sure write something very similar saying, is this going to be what it takes to destroy the credibility of the whole thing? Because it's beyond time that we stopped having these farcical pseudo trials for people who shouldn't be on trial and actually got to dealing with the issue of the very small number of apparently genuine terrorists that have been held at Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm. Well, it really does go to the smallness of Dear Leader when he could make the most right wing argument for closing down that thing, beginning with, I'm not afraid, and no one should be afraid that we can't hold trials for these guys. The Republicans in Congress would have us be afraid that if we hold a trial that that'll provoke terrorism. Oh, now terrorism has causes, huh? Things like fair trials are the cause. I thought it was just if you believe in Islam real hard, it makes you terrorists, huh, Republicans? Anyway, here's Colin Powell and George Bush and Robert Gates and every Republican that you need to name drop saying that Guantanamo Bay, and in fact, here's the director of the Central Intelligence Agency saying that this is a security threat to the United States. This helps with the enemy's recruiting propaganda against us, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's actually, the Republicans in the House are a bunch of tiny crying cowards if they think that we should have to do it their way. And Obama could win that argument in one press conference. Never even mind the fact that he's the commander in chief. And so he can move those troops if he wants. And Congress can't say anything about it. He could challenge them and say, go ahead and impeach me if you want. But I'm closing down Guantanamo prison and you can't stop me. And yet he won't do any of this stuff. In fact, I'm sorry, I'm still going. And I know the audience hates this too. But when he first came into power, Greenwald wrote this up and it was in the Washington Post, where important, very powerful, important senators, I think Leahy and Levin and them, were saying that they took him at his word. He meant to close Guantanamo. So they started to get the process going. And then they realized that he was having them stick their neck out, but he wasn't willing to help at all. And the White House was absolutely unwilling to ask anyone on Capitol Hill to go along with the project. And so they very quickly backed down because they realized they didn't have his support. And that was from the very beginning.
Yeah, well, and unfortunately, the situation we're in now is still that he's facing opposition and it remains to be seen if he will tackle it robustly enough. I mean, he has done things in the last few months. He has released, over two dozen prisoners, and that was an achievement. But, of course, nothing's happened for over a month now, in fact, getting on for two. So now we have to question whether he's got the resolve to keep pushing when he's up against, a hostile Republican-controlled Congress. And clearly, to not to criticize him on this point, because it is worth acknowledging he's up against something, even if he refuses to take his own responsibility serious enough. To have those bunch of senators recently, including, I'm sad to know, John McCain, who's now the chair of the Armed Services Committee and a man who should take his position responsibly, to have these people proposing a piece of legislation, which has now been passed by the committee, but we have to wait and see whether Congress will pass it, which is called the Protecting America from Terrorists Act 2015, which sounds current and serious. This is about not letting the president release anyone from Guantanamo under any circumstances during the rest of his presidency. Protecting America from Terrorists Act 2015, these are people who mostly have never been accused of terrorism. 54 of the guys that are held there have been approved for release by a high-level government task force of extremely responsible officials. So to have these guys cranking out some bit of fear-mongering legislation and unfortunately looking like they may get support for it because of the kind of wretchedly irresponsible nature of Congress is pretty depressing, actually, Scott.
Yeah. Well, and people should remember, too, that virtually everyone there was a nobody. until 2006 when the CIA closed down the black sites and brought the actual somebodies to Guantanamo, which was just another PR stunt.
We were talking about the supposed bad guys, Scott. You know, that's what people need to know. The number of people in Guantanamo who are facing trials or have faced trials is 10 people. There are 122 men left in Guantanamo. Now, you ask a right-winger and they'll tell you, yeah, yeah, they're bad guys, though, the rest of them. They may not be quite up at the level of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but they're all very dangerous people who mean us harm. And it's like, no. First of all, 54 of them nobody wants to hold, apart from Republican lawmakers. The government wants to let these people go because it says they're not a threat. The 58 others, the ones who are not cleared for release and are not facing trials. Okay, let's examine the cases of these people to find out how genuinely dangerous they are. Because you know what? It turns out that when you start examining the supposed evidence against them, the files of information that WikiLeaks released in 2011 with the information about other prisoners coming up with wonderful stories about their fellow prisoners, about how they were here and there and they did this and they did that. Turns out most of that's unreliable because, hey, these people were not questioned non-coercively. They were tortured. They were abused in other ways. Some of them were bribed. They were given comfort items. In other words, instead of being in a wretched, empty cell and having nothing, they were given things. They were given food to eat. They were allowed to watch films, whatever they wanted. If they would answer questions about their fellow prisoners, that they could put them in a file and look like they had evidence and look like they knew what they were doing. And that's what, you know, most of the guys that are still held in Guantanamo that the right-wingers will tell you are dangerous. This, when you examine this, it goes up in smoke, Scott. This isn't evidence at all. This is a real, real example of the monstrosity of Guantanamo. This is a house of cards built on torture and abuse. And that's what the supposed evidence is.
All right, Shell, that's the great Andy Worthington. Thanks so much for your work on this.
Scott, thank you. It's great to talk to you. And one of these days, maybe, we'll be looking back on it. But we're still not there, my friend.
Yeah, well, I'll keep working on it if you do. Well, one millionth the percent that you do, but, you know. Thanks again.
Will do.
All right, Shell. That's our friend Andy Worthington. He's at andyworthington.co.uk. andyworthington.co.uk. Get his book, The Guantanamo Files. Watch his movie, Outside the Law. And also read him at the Future Freedom Foundation and Al Jazeera. Up next, Jeff Tucker. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code SCOTT when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back.
Yeah, I kept Andy into the break there a little bit to finish up. So you'll be able to hear the end of that interview over in the archives at scotthorton.org later on. But right now, we go to our friend Jeffrey Tucker from Liberty.me. Welcome back to the show, Jeff. How are you? Oh, no.
Hey, it's good.
Connection problem, it says.
No. I got you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Yeah. I just switched connections. You know, it's amazing. I was on a bad Wi-Fi connection right before I got on. I just quickly switched to another one, and here we are.
So it didn't even just, kick you know, off, huh? It just kind of said, no, it's, for
yeah,
a second.
Right. Yeah, it's like sort of leaping from one building to the other, mm-hmm. you know, while dangerously risking falling to the ground, you know, and suddenly you grab on just to the ledge and pull yourself up. That's what just happened. All that just happened just now.
Yeah, and Skype magically kept the call going. I'll give them credit when they deserve it. It does sound better than a phone call for all the technical problems. And that was a technical success right there. That was that was something they deserve. All right.
Yeah, anyway. That felt good. That felt very, very cool.
Yeah.
I mean, and the timing was just exquisite.
Yes, it was right on time, right when I needed you. I actually was the bad timing there. If I hadn't caught myself by seeing the visual warning from Skype and just gone on, it would have been fine.
Man, what did you think when you saw that warning? Did you worry?
I worried. I thought, oh no, is it me or is it him? Who's got the problem with the broadband? But anyway,
there's some sense of uncertainty of the future, and then everything just locked into place. You know, it's just all happened in a split second. But that's very exciting.
Just how it's supposed to be. Yeah.
I am talking to you from the headquarters of the Foundation for Economic Education today, now. Yeah, I'm there.
Very interesting.
Yeah, we're just kind of doing a roundup of what's going on around here, and it's been a lot of fun. So I excuse myself from a staff meeting, and I know that nobody ever wants to leave a staff meeting ever.
I imagine they have a lot of books I would like to read there.
Well, it's kind of a high-techy office. I mean, we've sort of been radically digitized.
Yeah.
This is not the old fee mansion, you know. This is not your grandfather's fee anymore. This is a new sort of techy cubicle office. I kind of like it.
Hey, Jeff.
You have an
announcement. Make the announcement.
Yeah. Yeah, let's do it.
Hey, everybody. Jeff Tucker has an announcement coming up for you. Tell him, Jeff.
Yeah, well, the announcement. Now you're intimidating me. No, the announcement is that you and I are going to do a thing together. And we're going to do it every month without fail. And I'm going to learn from you. I'm going to sit at your feet so you can explain to me how the world works. And I'm excited about that.
Well, hopefully there's going to be some vice versa there, too. I think
I was planning to outsource my brain to you. You object to that?
Well, you know, a little. I'll tell you what we'll do. You say stuff and I'll say stuff, and it'll be great. The show is going to be called Eye on the Empire. Now, we hadn't even really had a chance to talk about this yet, but
this is our first time to talk about it.
Yeah, I think I explained this, I guess, to Mike, but I don't know if I've even had a chance to tell you why I wanted to name it that, Jeff, is because that was the name of Alan Bock's column at antiwar.com.
Yeah. Wow, this is a great man, yeah.
He was really great. Were you guys pals? Did you know him?
Yeah, I knew him well.
I mean, I assumed that you guys were buds, you know.
Yeah, we were buds. Yeah, yeah.
He's my hero, you know. He's the first guy I interviewed when I started the interview show his column at antiwar.com. And I learned so much from him over the years. And when I lived out in L.A., we got to be friends and hang out a couple times, which I feel very grateful for. But anyway, I thought, well, we should name the show Eye on the Empire.
I think that's a really nice idea. And we're going to invite people to join us and to do questions. And we're going to have fun, and we're going to learn a lot of stuff and get a lot of viewers, I think, and a lot of Q&A, a lot of interaction. It's going to be a lot of fun. A live show and on video and just the two of us with anybody who wants to join us.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that there's a lot of room here too for, my mind is kind of reeling at what all, you know, I have no idea what all you know, but I know it's a whole hell of a lot. And so, you know, hopefully
we kind of know different areas, right? I mean, like I'm my specialization is in economics and peer-to-peer technology and digital real estate and you know, that sort of thing.
But also libertarian principle and libertarian understanding and libertarian history and a lot of that stuff too. So that's certainly where I lack. I always have just outsourced my libertarianism to Anthony Gregory, like whatever he says, I'm pretty much for that.
Oh God, yeah, I know. I more or less feel the same way. In fact, I was just digging through the archives of Fee. Anthony Gregory had this amazing article on slavery, and I just learned so much from just from reading that.
Yeah, he's just so good. Brilliant. All this anarchism, I just I'm obsessed on a narrower kind of path most of the time.
Yeah.
But I love learning about it. I love talking about it, and I think it'll be really great to, you know, have much more libertarianism in, mixed in with my foreign policy stuff. So.
Well, and there's also a kind of an interesting intellectual history to talk about, because you're also interested in the history of American foreign policy, dating back to, say, you know, the post-war period up to the present. And so I have a lot of knowledge about how libertarians were responding during the Cold War to various events. You know, how during the 90s, after the Cold War ended, I personally remember many features of, you know, the first Iraq War and how libertarians were responding to that. And you know, so there's a very interesting sort of political intellectual history to discuss here, too. One thing that you find out more and more in this foreign policy realm, at least from what I can tell, is that it really does there's so many analogies in the past, right? There's hardly ever a new situation. People always think that it's new, you know? Like, oh my God, here's some foreign dictator we have to deal with. Oh, here's an oppressed people somewhere crying out for American intervention or whatever. But actually, in fact, it's just almost like a repeated situation again and again, you know? But people act as if it's fresh and it's new. And this generation's being uniquely called upon to save the world, you know? But we've always been there before.
Yeah. Well, and you know, even though we're a very small minority, us libertarians, all this terrible crisis is always, as Condoleezza Rice and Rahm Emanuel would say, great opportunity for us. I mean, I couldn't tell you, I'm sure you get this all the time too, but I couldn't tell you how many times I've had people tell me, well, you know, I was a liberal or a leftist or some kind of thing for a long time, but just you libertarians, you antiwar.com types are the ones who, through all of this, have kept your head. And you know, didn't deviate on Libya, didn't screw it up on supporting this or that revolution that, you know, some so-called peace groups decided to get on the bandwagon. And so I think, you know, as we switch from Republicans to Democrats in power, especially in the presidency, and then back again, we are in the position of basically catching everybody who's washing out of these liberal and conservative movements because they just can't stand the hypocrisy and the totalitarianism. And then, but who's standing there? Jeff Tucker's good on everything still after all this time, that kind of thing. And so, you know, it seems like, especially, I mean, my view is using foreign policy, but through economics and through so many other topics, we're the ones who are good on stuff across the board in a way that is good for bringing in new people, that they can pick up on one thing, the IRS here or a war there, and then understand the kind of unified field theory of liberty that we have to present.
Well, everybody else gets distracted by the changing power structures, you know? I mean, so, you know, if we get a Republican president next time around, you can just guarantee that suddenly all the Democrats and the left are going to be, you know, amazing on issues of civil liberties and foreign policy and all that kind of stuff. But then, you know, if they get their guy in charge again, suddenly it's going to be like a repeat of the Obama era where it's just, you know, see no evil, just look the other way and let the guy do what he wants. Reverse is true for the Republicans. You know, the Republicans have been severely critical of Obama, but all that will go away if they get their guy in office. So it gets tedious after a while because it's not really about principles. It's really about just backing their guy no matter what. It's nationalism in the end.
Yep. And but then again, you know, I think everything is just I don't know if it's accelerating or maybe I don't know. I didn't live through the Vietnam era or whatever. Maybe the cynicism and the dishonesty and the blatantness of it all was just as bad then. But it seems like it's getting worse and to our advantage in that sense. But now the guitars and drums mean that we got to take this break, Jeff. But
okay.
Hang tight right there. We'll be right back, y'all, with Jeff Tucker right after this. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The first of these great workshops is in Orlando, Saturday, March 7th. It's just $25. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions. Hey, guys. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Well, it's one of my shows, The Scott Horton Show. On the line is Jeffrey Tucker from Liberty.me, and we're talking about our new show. The premiere is tomorrow night at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, 8 o'clock Texas Time. So that'd be 6 o'clock dinner time if you live out in California. And the show is going to be called Eye on the Empire, and it's going to be live at Liberty.me. Now, I'm sorry, hard breaks interrupt there. So before we get back to the show and to Liberty.me and these other things, I think you were going to say something about the explosive growth of libertarianism in this day and age.
Oh gosh, I don't know. I mean, yeah, but just that we seem to be the only ones that keep our heads in the midst of all this partisan nonsense. You know, I'm so tired of this back and forth, handing the reins to this party, handing the reins to that party, and then everybody just sort of shutting up, you know, in a predictable, tedious way. So I hope that, you know, no matter who gets elected next time around, that there'll be at least some of us out there making a consistent case for peace and trade and for globalization of the right sort and not the wrong sort. I think it's an opportunity for us. I agree with you.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So
what are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about tomorrow night. I want to talk about this, the prospect of shutting out of the Department of Homeland Security, which is all over the news today, too. You know, that's.
Well, you know, we were just talking about, wait, a couple of things from the chat room. First of all, a short anecdote. Jeff's a great guy. I remember meeting him 20 years ago at a Ludwig von Mises event in which a professor of mine was speaking, sitting around the boardroom table as the talk was about to start. And this dandy-looking guy in a seersucker suit sits down next to me and pulls out a pouch of Red Man Chew and offers me some. I couldn't turn Jeff Tucker down. So that's a great memory from Fitzy G in the chat room there. I like that.
That is cute. I'm still doing the Red Man, that's for sure.
There you go. And then so also in the chat room earlier, got in a big argument accidentally about Homeland Security because I was saying I think it's actually within the realm of possibility that this thing is going to be broken up and spun off. And then the answer was, you're crazy. That couldn't possibly be true. And you know it, buddy. And so I'm not sure. I kind of think so. But what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty intense response. I don't know how anybody can know that.
Yeah.
I mean, oh my God. You know, this furlough, of course, is laughable. It's just, you know, a small fraction of the employees. And, you know, I guess it's 15%, but we all know that, you know, most of the employees of the Department of Homeland Security don't do anything anyway. So it's not going to make any difference, you know, either direction, plus or minus. So that doesn't matter. But yeah, I mean, it's possible that it could get broken up into various divisions at some point in the future.
See, my thinking is that the agencies that have been absorbed into this new department would rather be at least back under their old departments, right? Back under the Justice Department or back under Treasury. And because the agencies haven't really ceased to exist except for they redid the immigration control or whatever.
Structure. Yeah.
But I think a lot of the old fiefdoms are still there, but just subsumed. So I don't think that Liberty's going to win out here, but I was thinking that possibly ambition could be made to counteract ambition, and all these different pigs might stab each other in the back and throw each other all under the bus and demand to be spun off for their own sake, you know?
Yeah, and whoever's in charge will fob it off with some great increase in efficiency or some nonsense like that. So no matter what happens, it's not going to be good for Liberty, but it'll be proclaimed to be wonderful for good government and, you know, a vast improvement in our lives or whatever. You know, I do a lot of flying, Scott, around the country and out of the country. And I've noticed a big change in the TSA over the last several years. You know, not nearly as intense, not nearly as threatening as they used to be. But in a strange way that you get the sense that it's become so routine that not even the employees of the TSA take their jobs seriously anymore. You know, just there to have fun and they're also I think my general sense is the TSA employees are tired of being treated as enemies by passengers. So they're actually just in their own personal interest sort of reaching out to people and changing their ways in a way. I don't know if that's good or bad for security. I just noticed that it's a good example to me how bureaucracies don't really work, you know? They've never really been about security. It's been more about harassing Americans. But I think that the average, you know, worker in the TSA is just sort of fed up with the whole business. You should never forget that bureaucrats themselves face, in a way, the worst cost of bureaucracy there is. Yeah, they have terrible bosses and terrible coworkers and hate the systems that they work in.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you got to figure a lot of those people, they really want to do security work and do their part, they think, to keep dangerous people off of these planes, but they don't have the freedom within their job to even actually do that.
No, they end up just confiscating people's hair gel and, you know, bottles of liquor all the time. I mean, it's pretty boring and pretty terrible and has nothing to do with security, and they know this. I mean, every time I get my hands checked for bomb making materials, like do I have hand, you know, bomb hands? You know, there's an element of absurdity about the entire charade, you know? And look, everybody's just kind of like winking at each other and we're all rolling our eyes and we're like, why are we having to do this? Well, because the machine, you know, selected you randomly to check your hands for bomb making material. And the people who are doing the checking and holding you and all the rest of it, it's all become just a little bit silly, and everybody knows this.
Yeah. And that goes for really the rest of the state too. I think they got a real crisis of legitimacy going on here. But now, so.
Oh, yeah. And it starts at the core of the public sector bureaucracy. They're as demoralized as anybody else.
Yeah. Well, and at least there's that, you know, even if we can't get rid of them, we can be a little grateful and schadenfreude kind of thing. Not that I can pronounce German words.
Who really wants to work for the post office? You know, who really wants to work for the TSA? And I try to remember that too. You know, when I'm, you know, in the thick of these things, most of these people, this is sort of the best opportunities that they had, you know, thanks to a very truncated and statist regulated market. There aren't the kind of job opportunities that would be in a genuinely free society. A lot of these people are just choosing this line of work because it's the best that they could find.
Right. All right. Now, got a few minutes left. Let's get back to talking about business here. What's liberty.me, Jeff Tucker?
Oh, hey, you know, the last month or so has just been gangbusters. We didn't even open up a year ago. I guess we opened up our doors in May, and we had a kind of first iteration of the site. We finally took it out of beta, you know, a number or something like that. But it's really a very beautiful and engaging social platform, publications network, and content delivery service. We call it the Global Liberty Community because everything on the site is about human liberty in an applied and practical way. We're not just talking about politics, like who you should vote for or whatever, but really the things that you can do in your life to avoid the central plan and live a freer life. And there are so many of them. We have so many guides to that subject that you can download about using Bitcoin, avoiding the cops, moving to freer places away from tyranny. You know, I have a guide on hacking your house and getting rid of government controls and regulations, you know, finding medical care in the age of Obamacare. These are all the kinds of topics we cover. But what unites us as a community is just this love of freedom and a determination to find it, even in an age of despotism.
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful community. You can just join it up. You know, we give you 30 days for free. And after that, I think we're doing a $5 per month, kind of thing.
Unless they stop by scotthorton.org and click that link, then it's four.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's good. They should do that.
Or use promo code Scott.
And in the last month, we've signed up so many new members. I mean, you can just see them rolling in. You know, we put it on the front page, who's joining. And every time you join, you get a smattering of people that will just, you know, sort of welcome you and friend you. And it's a way to kind of build a network. And it's not just about building a network. It's about building liberty, as far as I'm concerned. That's why we started the institution in the first place. And things are just working out beautifully. I'm absolutely thrilled with it. But we also offer a lot of live shows, and I'm just really happy that our show is going to be one of the featured shows.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this thing. It's a great opportunity for me, and I hope it'll...
You will expand your audience, and you know, you'll expand ours. I mean, it's a win-win, no matter what.
Yeah, and I meant I had it here right in front of me, but I was looking at the wrong tab. I meant to mention that your column is called Beautiful Anarchy there at liberty.me, tucker.liberty.me. If people don't have to be members to read your articles, right?
That's your publishing site.
Is so, open to everyone.
Yeah, it's open to everybody. Mm-hmm. Hey, did you read my piece about 50 Shades of Grey?
No, I did not.
Oh, man. You got to click on tucker.liberty.me and have a look at my article on 50 Shades. I think you'll really like it.
Okay. I actually don't know anything about that movie other than it's like Skinamax kind of something.
Yeah, I know that's what everybody thinks, but actually I argue it's an allegory for how the state tries to control our lives.
Oh. Well, that I like naked girls too, so that sounds like a twofer in a movie like that. I'll at least read an article about it. All right. Thank you very much, Jeff. I'll see you tomorrow night at liberty.me.
Thanks so much, my friend. See you.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. That's Jeff Tucker. Find him at Amazon and at tucker.liberty.me. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.